Brothers and sisters, it's a real honor to have been asked to speak to you today, and a privilege to be here and to be involved in something connected with Ensign College, which I regard as one of the most interesting educational projects in the church, doing some very exciting things from what little I know about it. I have decided to talk to you about the subject of witnesses, and I call it Witnesses Assembled. You may wonder why I use the word assembled. It's because I'm going to be bringing them together in different groups to make my point. And witnesses have been very much on my mind of late. I've been involved in thinking about the witnesses for decades. I think that there are various groups, and they need to be understood as different groups, not just that there are additional witnesses, but different groups of them. So the witnesses assembled include the three witnesses. This is not an actual photograph of the three witnesses and Joseph Smith in the Grove waiting for the experience they were to have, but it comes from the film that I've been involved with. The eight witnesses are a separate and distinct group, and I'll talk about them. Then there are also what I call the unofficial witnesses, or the informal witnesses of the Book of Mormon. And I'll eventually add another group to that and talk about them briefly. But you've got these three distinct groups, the three witnesses, the eight witnesses, and the unofficial or informal witnesses. My interest in this was piqued, I suppose, kindled by a great scholar and a friend, Richard Lloyd Anderson, who passed away just in 2018. He was by far the leading expert in the church on the witnesses to the Book of Mormon, a very meticulous scholar and a very honest scholar who would devote his energy to tracking down the slightest evidence. And he put it together in a book that I think is one of the great classics of Latter-day Saint scholarship. I think him to be one of the great scholars in the Latter-day Saint tradition. This book is called Investigating the Book of Mormon Witnesses, and here's a comment from him in that, which I think is important and true. No testimony, he says, of direct revelation in the world's history is better documented than the testimony of the Book of Mormon witnesses. And that's why they're so interesting. You have ancient witnesses, but here you have modern witnesses awash in a sea of documents. We can know a great deal about them and their character. We know very little about Isaiah, essentially nothing. Apart from what is said in the Bible, essentially nothing about the apostles, the ancient apostles, apart from what's said in the Bible. But with the witnesses to the Book of Mormon, we can know a lot about their society, their culture, and them in particular. Now, I was in a position finally to do something about my interest in the witnesses, a long story that I won't bore you with. But I'm the president, as was mentioned, of something called the Interpreter Foundation. We publish a journal and so on. But we also got involved in movie making. And this is a scene from the set of the film that we did called Witnesses. You see Martin Harris there in the lower left-hand corner, Joseph Smith on the other side of the barrier. Emma Smith is coming into the room, and Mark Goodman, the director, who I hope never made it into any of the scenes. This was a complex enterprise, and it was a real learning experience for me. It was especially a learning experience to do it during the time of COVID. There's Joseph and Emma. I don't think they ever wore masks like that, but we had to wear masks through much of the production, except in the actual scenes themselves. It complicated things tremendously to make this film. Nevertheless, there are now three results from it, and I mention them just in passing. The theatrical film Witnesses, a documentary or docudrama that just came out called Undaunted, Witnesses of the Book of Mormon. And then we're doing short reels, 7 to 12 minute long segments where a scholar interacts with an interviewer to talk about issues raised by the witnesses. And that's available online at no cost. The others we've made available. It's a nonprofit organization, so I feel safe in making a commercial, if you don't mind. But the story of the witnesses begins in the Peter Whitmer cabin. Now, this is the Peter Whitmer cabin in upstate New York. Well, it is and it isn't. It's on the foundations, but it's reconstructed. But this is where the Whitmer family lived. So Peter and Mary Whitmer were the parents, and then quite a large family, including David Whitmer. It was from there that the witnesses went out to have the experience that they had. And there they are in actual photographs, or I guess technically the one of Oliver Cowdery is a daguerreotype. I don't know exactly how technically that differs, but it's apparently technically not a photograph. We're fortunate to have it. The photograph or daguerreotype of Oliver Cowdery was only found relatively recently. He died relatively young. That's why he looks relatively young. David Whitmer and Martin Harris lived to riper ages, and so the photographs of them are older. These are colorized, but they're actual photographs. We know now what they looked like. And so they have fascinating stories, which I can't tell you in detail, but lots of them that we've tried to incorporate into the films. Everyone is familiar, I hope, with the testimony of the three witnesses. It's worth reading, if you haven't read it recently. And seeing the nature of the thing. Now, I'm not sure, we've had a few technical issues. I'm not sure. I have a slide in which certain phrases are highlighted, but I'm not sure that's going to show up on the screen. Apparently not. So let me just emphasize those for you. There are certain things that the three witnesses claim. They say that they have seen the plates. We also know that they've been translated by the gift and power of God, for his voice hath declared it unto us. We declare with words of soberness that an angel of God came down from heaven, and he brought and laid before our eyes that we beheld and saw the plates and the engravings thereon. And then it closes, nearly closes, with this. The voice of the Lord commanded us that we should bear record of it. Wherefore, to be obedient unto the commandments of God, we bear testimony of these things. David Whitmer later told an interviewer that the angel had actually told him, if you ever deny what you have seen, you will be damned, which I think would be a good incentive to stick with your testimony. But the important thing to emphasize here is this was a supernatural experience. This involved seeing the plates, yes, but hearing the voice of God, seeing an angel descend from heaven. And they see a lot of objects. I'll come back to that in just a minute. Here again is that image of the four of them from the film, actors portraying those four, Joseph and the three witnesses, preparing to receive the witness that they did receive. Now, interestingly, Martin actually had his experience separately. He withdrew from the group feeling that he was the obstacle to the angel or the plates appearing before them. So he withdrew. He had the same experience later on that day with Joseph. David Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery had theirs with Joseph earlier. Now, one of the interesting things about this to me, and there are many, many interesting things to point out, is the fact that the Lord had already, in Doctrine and Covenants 17:1, said what he was going to show to the three witnesses. You shall have a view of the plates, and also of the breastplate, the sword of Laban, the Urim and Thummim, which were given to the brother of Jared upon the mount when he talked with the Lord face to face, and the miraculous directors, that is the Liahona, which were given to Lehi while in the wilderness on the borders of the Red Sea. So there's a kind of promissory list here of the things that the witnesses will see. That's really daring if you're Joseph Smith and you're making it up. You've got to somehow get these guys out into the woods and have them see all the things that you've just promised them they would see. So is he able to do that? Well, Joseph isn't able to do that. That's the point. But here's what David Whitmer later says in an interview. He says that the angel showed to us the plates, the sword of Laban, the directors, that is the Liahona, the Urim and Thummim, and other records. There appeared, as it were, a table with many records on it, besides the plates of the Book of Mormon, also the sword of Laban, the directors, and the interpreters. I saw them as plain as I see this bed. And then the person to whom he's speaking records that he struck his hand upon the bed beside him to make the point. It was solid. I see the bed very clearly. He would often say to people, when they would say, well, you know, maybe it was dark, you couldn't really see clearly, the angel was a long distance away, he'd say, young man, the angel was closer to me than you are. I know what I saw. So, but here, the Lord has made a promise of what would be shown to them, and David Whitmer later testifies, he saw exactly those things that Doctrine and Covenants 17:1 said he would see. If you're a fraud, I just wonder, how did he pull that off? How would he have done that? So the evidence to me is that Joseph was not a fraud, and I'll be saying more about that. Here's Brother Anderson again. Nothing short of biblical Christianity furnishes such a concrete statement of supernatural reality. One cannot dismiss the experience easily, for each man so testifying impressed his community with his capacity and unwavering honesty, and all three consistently reaffirmed the experience in hundreds of interviews throughout their lives. Now, I want to expand on that just a little bit. One of my favorite arguments against the church that I ever heard was someone who said, look, David Whitmer remained faithful to the Book of Mormon and bore his testimony because he was terrified of Brigham Young. He knew that Brigham would have him done in if he ever dared tell the truth. Well, there are some issues with that. First of all, Brigham died in 1877 and David Whitmer died in 1888. He had 11 years. And he still goes on bearing his testimony. And then the thing that really struck me when I went to the cemetery where he is buried. I should have had a picture of this in here. But there's a stone pillar on his grave, which he asked to be put there. On the top of it are carved in stone two books, clearly meant to be the Bible and the Book of Mormon. And then on one side of the pillar, it says, "The record of the Jews and the record of the Nephites are one. Truth is eternal." Now, he's bearing testimony after his death. Surely by this point, he's not scared of Brigham Young anymore. But he knew the Book of Mormon was true, and he wanted to bear testimony forever. He had it literally engraved in stone. All right, now then there's a very different kind of testimony, the testimony of the eight witnesses. And I used to wonder, well, why three and eight? When I was younger, I couldn't figure it out. It just seemed strange. Okay, so you have three and then you add eight more. So now you've got 11. Well, that's nice. But as I thought about it more, I realized that the eight witnesses are very, very different from the three witnesses. Their experience is fundamentally different. If you read their testimony, you'll notice it's restrained. It's matter of fact. It's legalistic almost. As many of the plates as the said Smith has translated, we did see with our eyes. You know, it's written in the kind of language that lawyers write, which can be really dull. Anyway, but the point is to be very careful. They saw the plates, which they said had the appearance of gold. Now, they're not metallurgists, and they didn't perform a chemical test on the plates. They just say they had the appearance of gold. They saw the engravings on those plates, which they said had the appearance of ancient work and of curious workmanship. They don't claim to have seen the Liahona, the breastplate, the sword of Laban, or the Urim and Thummim. There's no audible divine voice, no heavenly confirmation. But they do use the word heft repeatedly, to heft something. They hefted the plates. And to me, this indicates heaviness. The plates are tangible. They're not something in Joseph Smith's imagination. They're not hallucinatory. They are a solid metal object, and a rather substantial one. Richard Anderson again. Eight farmers and artisans publicly reported that Joseph Smith had shown them ancient plates of the Book of Mormon. A practical group who worked with their hands, they were better able to evaluate the appearance of gold and the curious workmanship than eight picked at random from a modern city. Now, I've had some people say to me, oh, well, these people were sort of divorced from reality, you know, they lived in a primitive world and so on. Let me ask you, many of us spend our lives staring into a computer screen in an air-conditioned or heated room, under artificial lighting. Who's divorced from reality? These are the guys who are out there pulling up tree stumps and moving rocks and building fences and digging wells, right? I think they're more tightly tied into reality than we tend to be. And the fact that they said, we hefted these plates, we turned the pages, that impresses me a great deal. And all of them, like the three, remained faithful to the Book of Mormon and their testimony of the Book of Mormon for the rest of their lives. So you have these two groups, and it seems to me that they constitute a real challenge to critics. The three witnesses, you could say, well, okay, it was hallucination. It was a vision. We all know visions aren't real. Actually, we don't all know that, but some people say that. And they want to dismiss it as being not real, it's fantasy. That explanation doesn't work for the three, but it certainly doesn't work for the eight, because the eight go out into a grove of trees at about 1 p.m, absolutely matter of fact, no angel, no voice of God, nothing like that. Joseph Smith produces the plates, lets them hold them, turn the pages, and so on. It's as down to earth as it can possibly be. On the other hand, if you try to go with the eight witnesses first, and you say, Well, so Joseph faked some plates. Harder to do, by the way, than you might think. One of the things in our documentary is an interview with a metallurgist who has made the plates for the church's visitor centers. He says, you know, I'm a professional metallurgist. It's hard for me to do this. Joseph didn't just pound out some plates, you know, and pass them off. That's easy to say, hard to do. But assume, okay, that he did. Okay, so he takes some yokel farm boys out into the grove of trees, and he shows them these plates, and they fall for it. Fine, you think you've dismissed the eight witnesses, but you haven't touched the three witnesses. What do you do with the voice of God, the descent of an angel, all the other objects, not just the plates, but the sword of Laban, the Leahona, all these other things that the three witnesses see? An explanation that works for one doesn't work for the other group. It seems to me the difficulty isn't only arithmetic. You know, it's twice as hard with two groups. It's four times as hard. I don't know how to calculate it, but something like that. It is much more difficult. And what price did they pay for it? Here's one of my favorite examples, but it's not by far the only example. These men who testified of the Book of Mormon were driven from state to state and so on and ridiculed for the rest of their lives, really. They suffered for it. They paid a price for it. But here's one price they paid. You may know about the mission to the Lamanites, where Oliver Cowdery and Peter Whitmer Jr. And Parley Pratt is another. There were four of them who went out on a mission to the borders of the Lamanites, that is, to the western border of Missouri, early on in the church's history. And it was one of the worst winters in the history of the United States. The snow was often up to their waists. They said that the wind was in their faces almost the whole way, freezing their skin. They were really, really miserable. And I'm thinking, okay, if I'm Oliver Cowdery and I'm in on some sort of scam or fraud, about 1,000 miles into this, I'd be thinking to myself, you know, this isn't as fun as I thought it would be. I think I'll opt out. I'm just going to take off. It didn't really happen. Forget about it. Sorry I ever mentioned the Book of Mormon. But Oliver is a believer. He wants to get out, and it's his idea, really, to go preach the gospel in the borders of the Lamanites, because they are the people he thinks who need to hear this news, that the record of their ancestors has been found. He believed. He was sincere. And so were the other witnesses. Now I'm going to get to what I call the informal or unofficial witnesses. And there are several of them. In fact, there's one that I haven't even included here because I just heard about him a short while ago and want to research this. I think there's another witness out there who saw the plates or hefted them anyway. And a really, really interesting case. Never joined the church. And he's quite famous for other things. But William Smith, the younger brother of Joseph Smith, is one of the witnesses. He actually held the plates on a couple of occasions, at least. And he testified that they were very, very heavy. He wasn't one of the three or the eight. But he held the plates and he said they weighed about 60 pounds. Now, that's at the high end of the estimates. Most of the estimates put them about 40 to 45 pounds. But what he's saying is they were tangible. They were a solid object. The family knew that Joseph had something that was really, really heavy. And he had to move it around a little bit. Josiah Stoll is one of my favorites because I didn't know about him until a few years ago. Josiah Stoll was the man for whom Joseph used to work occasionally. He's interesting because he wasn't primed to see the plates. He saw them by accident. And he testified to it under oath in a jury trial. He was asked by a prosecuting attorney, "So, how do you know that Joe Smith had the plates?" He says, "Because I saw them. I was reading through that trial transcript and I thought, my word, I didn't know this." Well, he said, when Joseph was handing the plates to him, covered in a cloth through a window, the cloth came off one corner of the plates and he saw the metal plates underneath and they glistened in the light. This is a man who was not primed. Some people have dismissed the three and the eight and said, well, they worked themselves into a spiritual state and imagined these things. Well, he was just taking something, passed through a window and saw it. Very matter of fact. Lucy Harris. You may not have thought of Lucy Harris as a witness to the Book of Mormon. She's the wife of Martin Harris, and she's really mad at him for spending money on the printing of the Book of Mormon. But she is a witness. She said that at one point, in a dream or in a vision, it's not clear which, an angel appeared to her and showed her the plates and turned them page by page and commanded her to stop speaking evil of the Lord's anointed. Now, I think it changed her ways for about 3 days. And then she went back to speaking evil of the Lord's anointed. But one of the things she did was to donate a substantial amount of money for the standards of her day to Joseph Smith to help him have food to eat while he was translating. She is probably the very first person to donate money to the cause of the Book of Mormon, which is really ironic given her overall history. Lucy Mack Smith, the mother of the prophet, actually held and felt the Urim and Thummim and the breastplate. She said she could see through the cloth that covered it. It must have been a very thin cloth and not very expensive or dense. She could see the glint of the metal through the cloth of the breastplate beneath. So these objects were tangible. They were real. There was something. The evidence shows that Joseph had something in 1828-29. Catherine Smith, his younger sister, at one point, Joseph comes into the house. He's been chased by a mob. He hands the plates to her and says, "Go hide these. The mob is coming." She takes them, staggers in under the weight. She's very young. Staggers in under the weight and puts them under the covers of her bed, and then climbs in, pretends to be asleep. And the mob doesn't bother her. So they don't find the plates. And she remarks later on in her life, she says, "They were really, really heavy." So they were tangible. Emma Smith, another of my absolute favorites. Emma Smith used to have to move the plates sometimes when she was dusting. Joseph would go off, and this is amazing if he's faking it. Joseph would go off to do something, and he would leave the plates on the table, covered with a thin cloth. And Emma would sometimes have to move them. She said they were really heavy. Have to move them so that she could dust or do whatever she was doing with her housework. And Emma spent quality time with the plates, I think. She says later on in an interview that she felt along the one edge, she could feel the pages, the leaves of the plates. They felt like the unusually thick pages of a book. She moved the top plate and heard it scrape metallically on the plate beneath it. She felt the three rings on the other side of the plates. I have to be honest, she was asked, "Did you ever see the plates?" No. But I would like to ask her, "Come on, Emma, between you and me. You're alone with them. You're obviously standing there feeling them very carefully. Come on, I know what I would have done." She said, "I know that my husband had the plates," and she did. Now, whether she ever looked, I don't know. But again, she's testifying not only to the heaviness of the plates and the material reality of them, but to the description of them with the rings on the side, the pages, and metallic sound and all that kind of thing. Mary Musselman Whitmer, you may know this story. I don't know if you know all the story. Mary Whitmer was the mistress of the home in which Joseph and Oliver Cowdery were doing the translation and dictation. And she was frankly getting a little angry with them, because they were out there translating, dictating, taking dictation, and they were farm boys. So, you know, this kind of sitting work didn't appeal to them. So every once in a while they would get up and they'd go out just to get a little exercise and fresh air and light, and they would skip rocks on the lake, a little pond, and things like that. Well, meanwhile, visitors are coming all the time and they're staying, and Mary is having to feed them and take care of them and do all the housework. I'm sure a lot of women can appreciate this. The men are doing the important things. The women are doing the work that makes the family run, right? And important things in quotes, right? So she was getting to the point where she was going to ask Oliver and Joseph to leave. One day, and we have three lines of source for this, that she told the story to three members of her family who later recorded it. She said she was out in the barn doing farm work, and a stranger appeared to her and called her by name, which surprised her because she didn't think that, how did he know my name? And she said, "What do you want?" And he said, "Well, you've been under a lot of stress and pressure lately," I'm paraphrasing, "and it's only fair that you should see the plates, that you should have a glimpse of what's going on." He had a backpack. He took it off. He took the plates out and showed them to her and allowed her to turn the plates and examine the plates. She never complained thereafter. She knew that Joseph wasn't making it up. Now, the interesting thing about the unofficial witnesses to the Book of Mormon is that their encounters with the plates and what seems to be an angelic messenger, certainly in Mary Whitmer's case, actually happened before the official witnesses. Brother Anderson, these private encounters with the metal book preceded both the three witnesses seeing the angel on plates and also the eight witnesses handling the plates in natural surroundings. So there is something significant about those witnesses, I think, the unofficial witnesses. They're different. They don't expect to see the plates. They're surprised by them. They're not primed to have some sort of spiritual experience. They just have it and then report it. It's also interesting that there are several women among them, but there are no women among the official witnesses. Let me just speculate on that really quickly here, here's my suggested reason. Women could not serve on juries. Women could rarely serve as witnesses in American courts of the time. Their testimony would not be taken seriously. It's amazing, if you look up the record of when women were admitted to serve on juries, how late that happened. In some states, into the 50s and the 60s before women were allowed. It's stunning to me. I was completely surprised. Some of you may have heard of or seen a play or a movie, a famous film, called 12 Angry Men, about a jury. But think about the title. This movie was made in the 50s or 60s, late 50s, I think. And it's about a jury, and it's 12 angry men. Think about how odd that is. It was only men, as late as that. So I'm not surprised that women's testimonies were not included among the official testimonies, because they wouldn't be taken seriously. Women couldn't own property. There were all sorts of restrictions on women. You're having to speak into the society of the day. But the Lord didn't leave women without witnesses, and several of the unofficial witnesses are women. And their witnesses are in some ways just as impressive as the official witnesses. But then I want to talk about, in closing, another group of witnesses who are women. Who are the first people at the tomb of Jesus? It's women. They go there, they find that the stone has been rolled away and the tomb is empty. And when they go back, remember, they say to the apostles, "We've been there, the tomb is empty." And if you recall one of the scriptural comments about it, the apostles didn't respond particularly well. "It seemed to them as idle tales," the King James Bible says. They didn't believe them. Hysterical women, you know, you can't take them seriously. Because in first century Judaism, the testimony of a woman was not acceptable in court either. So I think it's significant, by the way, that the first witnesses to the resurrection, according to the scriptures, are women. Why is this significant? Because I don't think a Jew writing in the first century who's making the story up would have chosen it to be women. He would have chosen men. If you're making it up, you can choose anybody you like, right? But it's women in the accounts because they really were the first witnesses there. The first, in a sense, apostolic witness ever born of the resurrection of Jesus is borne by women. That's really interesting to me. And you may notice in 1 Corinthians 15, when the Apostle Paul runs through a list of the witnesses of the resurrection, he doesn't include the women. Why doesn't he? I don't know. But here's one possible reason. Paul is a lawyer and a Pharisee, and he knows the rules for courtroom testimony in Jewish law, and so he just doesn't bother to include the women. It's just all the men who'd seen the resurrection of Jesus, or beheld the resurrected Jesus. Now, let me go on about one more of those unofficial witnesses, and that is Mary Magdalene. Here are the official witnesses, unofficial witnesses, eight witnesses. Here's Mary Magdalene. You remember the story. Mary Magdalene sees the gardener, she thinks, and then when he calls out her name, she realizes who it is. I'm sure that there's a subtle difference between seeing someone battered and bruised and dead on the cross and seeing him glowing with life when you hadn't expected to see him at all. He calls out her name and she says, "Rabboni, my master." And then there's a funny passage. He says to her, "Touch me not, for I have not yet ascended to my Father which is in heaven." Now, I've heard sermons and gospel doctrine lessons on this, and it's one of my pet peeves, so I'm going to express it here. This is an image from a Russian painter, and you see Mary Magdalene reaching out, and Jesus being basically saying, "Don't touch me, hands off, stay away." I don't think that's what happened at all, and let me tell you what happened here. The Greek verb that's translated as "touch me not" it's an inceptive aorist in Greek. We don't have that in English. It doesn't mean to not do something. It means to stop doing something that you are doing. So she has touched him already. And it doesn't mean just a touch either. Memu haptu means, well, haptu, haptomai means don't adhere to me, don't cling to me, don't attach yourself to me. Basically, I think Jesus, she has thrown herself at him. Can you imagine the response? Very human scene. She throws herself at him and is embracing him. And he's saying, he's trying to peel her off a little bit and to say, look, I'm sorry, I can't stay. I've got to go. I'll be back, but I've got to go. But it's a very different scene. I've heard gospel doctrine teachers speculate, well, maybe you have to kind of, the resurrected body has to go up to heaven and be certified by the Father or something before it's okay to touch it. Nothing to do with that. She's grabbed him, is holding on to him, and he's saying, I've got to go. Stop clinging to me, please. I've got to go. So a powerful scene. Well, why do I bring this in? I just want to tell you that the witnesses to the Book of Mormon and the witnesses to the resurrection, of which the women are only some. Can we get to the slide of, well, there they are, to that slide. Yes, this is an image from a church, and this is the last one, I think. We'll see if I'm surprised. This is an image from a church just outside the walls of ancient Constantinople, today's Istanbul. It's called the Kora Church, the country church. And I love it because it's called the Resurrection, He Anastasis. And there you see Jesus. It's not what we would call the resurrection. They use the term more broadly than we do. But what he's doing in this, he's pulling Adam out of his tomb. He's pulling Eve out of her tomb on the other side. He's trampling on the gates of hell. He has burst into Hades, the spirit world, spirit prison, if you will, and he's freeing the spirits that are there. This is the scene that Joseph F. Smith saw in his famous vision of the redemption of the dead. And in this scene, he is standing on those gates of hell. You see the two, they're doors. He's broken them apart. He's burst into the place. And under his feet, in that little blue area, there's all the lock mechanism. He's just burst the lock, destroyed it. And if you look very carefully, there's a kind of odd figure. You can hardly tell him under the one of the doors there. That's the devil. He's standing on him. And what this shows is Christ's triumph over death and sin and all of those other things that are our enemies. And this is what these testimonies are so important about. The Book of Mormon is important in its own right. It's most important as something that points to other things. It points to the fact that there is a God, that there is a God who loves us and who intervenes in history. And he has a son, Jesus Christ, who came to redeem us and to save us. And that son rose from the dead. He freed the spirits from spirit prison. As he will do for all of us, he frees us from our sins. And he will ultimately defeat Satan and put down the rebellion of Lucifer. This is the most important message that we can know. It's the most important message that we can share. And it's the most important message to which the testimonies of the Book of Mormon itself, all the testimonies in the scriptures point, which is that God lives, that Jesus is the Christ, and in the case of the Book of Mormon, that the church has been restored. I bear you my testimony that these things are true, that the gospel is true, that there is hope, that life doesn't end with death, that there is purpose in this life, there's a loving God who cares about us, and he is restored his authorized church, which is led today by prophets and apostles. And I bear you that testimony in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.